This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest, actor Andrew Rannells, originated the role of Elder Price in the Broadway musical The Book of Mormon. In HBO's Girls, he played Elijah, Hannah's former boyfriend. Now he's starring in the TV comedy The New Normal, which was co-created by Ryan Murphy, who also co-created Glee and created Nip Tuck. In The New Normal, Rannells plays a gay man who's in a relationship with a character played by Justin Bartha. They decide that they're ready to have a child, so they hire a surrogate. In this scene from the first episode of The New Normal, Rannells and Bartha are sitting on a park bench watching parents with their children. Bartha speaks first.
You really think it's such a good idea to bring a kid into the world with such a non-traditional family?
I know somebody else from a non-traditional family. A African-American who was raised by a grandma. And that person seems to be doing just fine.
Oh, yeah. Barack Obama.
And Mariah Carey. Your example works, too.
Andrew Rannells, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the new series. Are you hoping that this show will help convince mainstream audiences who aren't already convinced that gay people can make great parents?
I hope so. I mean, I hope that, and certainly, you know, I think that, you know, Modern Family has done a really fantastic job. Jesse Tyler Ferguson and Eric Stone Street's characters have really done a great job, I think, of opening a lot of eyes to how normal, quote unquote, like, you know, gay couples are, and like, well, they're just like us. And if this is the next part of that, to show sort of, you know, the beginnings of that relationship and also the beginning of the family and what exactly, you know, gay couples have to go through to start a family, because it's not an easy process. It's an expensive process and it's a lengthy process, and it doesn't always work. And I think it's exciting to get to sort of show that for, you know, one of the first times on television, I think is exciting. My sister Becky in Omaha recently said that she coined the phrase swing straights, that she thought that, like, after watching this pilot, she was like, I think this will, you know, potentially sway some folks who don't think they have anything in common with gay people, or they don't know any gay people, or this could potentially change some minds. So Becky Britt in Omaha, Nebraska, you know, swing straights, which I think that's a great term.
Very good. Very good. Network standards. Are network standards any different for gay characters than they are for straight characters when it comes to embraces and the bedroom?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because I didn't think so, and we have not, to my knowledge, come up against any. There haven't been any questions. And, you know, Justin and I, there's a scene in our pilot that where Justin and I are, you know, we are in bed and we kiss, and it's actually a really loving moment about when we decide who is going to be the biological father of this child that we're creating. And nobody ever said anything about it, you know, as far as I know, at the network or standards and practices or anything. But then yesterday, I was recording the show on my DVR, just sort of, you know, scrolling through, because it airs, you know, on the next week, and I was recording it, and I noticed that in the description it said intense sexual situations, which I thought was very odd. I mean, it said, like, you know, strong adult humor or something, which, you know, it does skew, you know, I suppose, in that direction. But intense sexual situations, I thought that was odd, and I wanted to ask Ryan and Allie about that, about if they had, you know, and I'm not sure if that's for everything, if that's, you know, if that's included on, you know, Desperate Housewives, is that on, you know, the description of Grey's Anatomy, or was that because it's two gay men kissing? I don't know. I mean, we're not on a cable network. We're on NBC, so there's not, and we're not setting out to do an intense sexual show. That's just not the story we're telling. But it will be interesting to see sort of what the reception is of just, you know, simple physical contact, or, you know, little intimacies.
So Ellen Barkin plays the grandmother of the woman who becomes your surrogate. And Ellen Barkin, at least in the first episode of The New Normal, she's like racist and homophobic. She's got a bad word for everybody.
yeah, she's an equal opportunity.
Yeah, and there's one, I mean, I thought it was like a funny joke. She sees what she thinks are two men walking down the street with a baby, and she thinks, like, that's disgusting, like, two men with a baby, like, they shouldn't be parents like that. And then her daughter says to her, Mom, they're lesbians.
Yes.
And so I wonder if there's, like, a homophobic joke that strikes you as the funniest of the homophobic jokes in the pilot.
In the pilot?
Or further in.
She at one point calls Justin and I salami smokers, which is you know, so ridiculous, but kind of hilarious. And what's better, I think, is that Ryan let me react rather honestly to that, which I said, I was like, oh, that's a good one. which it was a last minute change in the script, and that's what came out of my mouth when she said it. So he let me say that in the pilot. Oh, that's new. That's a good one. Because I think that particularly, like, as a, you know, as a gay man, I've heard, like, all, I feel like I've heard them all at this point. So you have to have a certain sense of humor about it, I suppose. But our writers do come up with really creative ways to offend lots of people. So as the scripts keep coming in, it's, I think we're all still regularly surprised. Even Ellen, that, you know, that she's gets to say some of the things that she's going to say.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Rannells. He stars in the new NBC comedy series, The New Normal, and he starred in the Book of Mormon. He just left the show in June in order to do The New Normal. Andrew Rannells, that show was so good, and you were so terrific in it. I was lucky enough to see you in the show. And so before we go any further, I want to play something from the cast recording with you singing, and I thought we'd hear I Believe. I Believe is a parody of songs that are anthems of affirmation. Tell us what you think of this song and what songs you were thinking of when you sang it, or what songs you think Trey Parker and Matt Stone were thinking of when they co-wrote it.
Sure. The song that I think you know, Trey sort of explained with the, particularly the opening of I Believe is sort of a tribute to I Have Confidence from The Sound of Music, where Julie Andrews is leaving the convent to go, you know, be the nanny to the Von Trapps. And so that was sort of always in my head. But as I sort of worked on it more, it is there's sort of a Disney-esque quality to it. It's usually like the Disney heroine has a moment of singing a song that she's sort of affirming her own belief, or her own belief in herself, normally is what the song is. So I absolutely loved singing it every night. It was my favorite part of doing the show was getting out there and belting that song out.
And talk a little bit about the lyric.
The lyric is all Trey and Bob, Parker and Matt Stone and Bobby Lopez like to remind everyone that the chorus of the song lists facts from the Book of Mormon. Sort of the fundamental beliefs of the Mormon Church are listed, but in sort of a 1-2-3, you know, punch joke format. But they are all true. There's no joke in I Believe, Trey liked to tell people.
Okay, so this is my guest, Andrew Rannells, from the original cast recording of the Book of Mormon.
You cannot just believe partway. You have to believe in it all. My problem was doubting the Lord's will instead of standing tall. I can't allow myself to have any doubt. It's time to set my worries free. Time to show the world what Elder Price is about and share the power inside of me.
About black people.
That's Andrew Reynolds from the cast recording of the Book of Mormon. So what reaction would you get to that song every night?
I mean, as a performer, it was always a really thrilling thing to do because it was, I think, the audience sort of, they enjoyed it. I think it was a great moment, I think, in the story and also sort of an unexpected moment for my character to sort of, you know, rebound with that much belief in his faith. So, yeah, the response was always very exciting. And then, so I think it was, you know, I got to perform that song at the Tony Awards, which was a huge, huge thrill for me, and it's such an honor to get to represent our show like that. And after that, it became sort of like the song from the Tonys. So for a few months after that, I would start to sing it, and I would hear people in the audience like, "This is the one from this is what he sang on the Tonys." So it was exciting. It took on sort of a different meaning for people. My mother has really been getting a kick out of, with Mitt Romney running for president, on a lot of news programs, they show clips of me singing, particularly that verse about in 1978, God changed his mind about black people. People like to play that on like news magazine shows. So she really likes to see that. Oh, they talked about Mitt Romney and they showed that clip of you singing. It's nice to be so closely linked.
along similar lines, Newsweek had a cover. Where was you on the poster for the Book of Mormon?
Yeah, it was my body and Mitt's head.
And Mitt Romney's head, yeah, which was odd. Did they ask you for permission? Did they tell you in advance that was going to happen?
They must have asked someone. They didn't ask me. They didn't need to ask me, but they must have.
So how'd you find out?
I'm sure. It appeared in my dressing room. One of our publicity department for the Book of Mormon gave me a copy of it, and... they said that you are sort of on the cover of Newsweek. No one knows it's you except for you. But yeah, there you are on the cover of Newsweek.
So were you a fan of Trey Parker and Matt Stone's South Park?
Huge, huge fan of that. I believe it started like my senior year of high school or something. Or maybe my junior year of high school. And I just, I went to an all boys Catholic high school, so needless to say, it was like nuts. Like everybody knew what that was. Everybody was watching that, and the movies were so funny, and Team America was so great, and they were such the crazy personalities. Going to the Oscars dressed as Gwyneth Paltrow and Jennifer Lopez, like so bizarre, and they just seem so larger than life. And I never would have expected to get the chance to work with them, but it was so thrilling to do so.
So you left the show in June, and I imagine that was in order to start the new normal. Were you ready to leave the show? And had you gotten tired of it? I always wonder, no matter how wonderful a show is, if you get tired of doing it every night.
Yeah, I mean, there's a level of, I think we did close to, I personally did close to like 500 performances by the time that I left, which is, that's a lot. That's a lot 8 times a week, and it really takes over your whole life, and it affects everything. It affects how you sleep and when you eat and when you go to the gym, and it takes over everything. But at the same time, there was such a sense of ownership of the role and of the show that I felt so responsible for presenting it every night that I can't ever say that I got sick of it. And I've never felt that doing a live show. I felt like it was somehow important, and that I needed to present this to the audience every night. So it was always, always truly a joy to do it every night. But there does come a time where you don't want to overstay your welcome. And it started to become something larger with a tour and then a company in Chicago. And they're talking about a company in London. And it started to get bigger. And I think that Josh Gad and I both sort of felt like that was kind of the natural time to maybe move on to our next project as the show sort of graduated into something larger. Luckily we were both presented with opportunities to do so. I wouldn't have left had I not had this opportunity. I would have happily stayed doing the Book of Mormon. But the timing just worked out as such that this another amazing opportunity presented itself, and it all just felt like, good timing to sort of leave.
Yeah, you said you felt this sense of ownership. This was the first role that you had originated, because your roles in Hairspray and Jersey Boys, other people had done it first.
Yeah, it's a different, and that's a whole different skill, you know, to walk into a show that exists and try to make it your own as much as possible is, that's hard. And it never really feels like it's yours. So to start something from scratch and to do something first that no one else has ever seen and to be so tied to a role is, it's exciting, but it's a little daunting sometimes, you know, are people going to believe me as, you know, something else? Are people going to, you know, accept me as somebody else?
So you had a great part in the first season of Girls, the HBO series created by and starring Lena Dunham. And I want to play a clip from one of the scenes that you're in. And this, okay, so this is an episode in which she's found out that she has an STD. And she's been told to, like, get in touch with people she's slept with. So you play her former college boyfriend. She hasn't been in touch with you for a while. So, you know, she calls you up, dinner reservations, nice restaurant. She kind of dresses up. She obviously wants to look really attractive. And either she's still maybe carrying the torch a little bit for you, or she's hoping that you're going to be a little jealous that she has a boyfriend. But in that scene, you reveal to her that you're actually gay. And
yes.
Like she is totally unprepared to hear that. So here's her response.
So I'm processing this. Does this mean that the whole time we were together, you were?
I mean, you're asking, did I always want to have sex with men? Yes. Are you asking, did I think about it when we were together? Yes.
So then how were you able to have sex with me?
Well, there's a handsomeness to you, just...
Oh, all right, that
wasn't the right...
Well, I am very, very happy for you.
Thank you. That means a lot to me.
But I do wish that you could have maybe figured this out a little bit sooner, like maybe when we were at liberal arts college, because there were a lot of gay men there.
Okay. Now, I just feel like there's a lot of aggression coming off of you.
And we're just going to fast forward a little deeper into this scene. So here's the rest of the scene.
This is not the time for you to throw stones because you know what? I'm the one who was lied to for by you for 2 years.
Well, I think it was Maya Angelou who said we are only as blind as we want to be.
So you're saying that I was supposed to know that you were gay? Because let me tell you something. This fruity little voice that you've put
on
is a new thing.
Fruity little voice? Is this about the scarf?
It's not about the scarf. The scarf is not helping the situation, but it's about your tone of voice. It's about your mannerisms. And in my
I'm my authentic self. I am being my authentic self.
If you had been this gay in college, I would have known because I have two eyeballs, two ears.
You might want to take some steps back through your other boyfriends. And not for nothing, maybe take a look at your dad.
You didn't just... In what way does my father read gay to you?
Well, he has a stud in his ear.
He got it on a trip he took with a bunch of his male friends. I heard
are
what that
hearing?
Sounded like.
Are we hearing ourselves?
I heard what that sounded like.
I don't think we are.
You know what I'm going to do from now on?
What are you going to do?
Ask people if they're gay before I have sex with them.
Good luck with that. Good luck with that. And don't be surprised if people ask you if you keep dressing like that.
I'm going to have the last word in this situation.
It was nice to see you.
No.
Your dad is gay.
No.
I have heard that scene so many times. It is so funny. That's Andrew Rannells, my guest, along with Lena Dunham in a scene from her series, Girls. Did you improvise any of that?
We did. We did improvise a lot of that. She was very generous in that sense. I mean, the script was hilarious. And then we did it, you know, several times as written, and Judd Apatow, who was the executive producer of the show, was also on the set that day, and he sort of was feeding us some suggestions about where the conversation might be able to go, including, you know, me telling her that I think her dad is gay and things like that. He would just sort of come over and, like, whisper little things to each of us. And she's so – I can't say enough good about that lady. She's just – I love Lena a lot, and I think that she's so talented and so generous to work with. And so we just had a lot of fun, and she's really fun to play with.
Who came up with that line of, like, well, there's a certain handsomeness?
I'm sad to say that was my own creation. She recently they're gonna release the DVD of the first season, and she and another producer, executive producer Jenny Connor, asked if they could include my audition on the DVD. I think everybody's audition, but my audition was also going to be in there, which included a lot of improvising. And you kind of black out when you audition. You know, I don't remember half the things that I said that day. So it was really terrifying to actually have to, like, sit and watch it, because you never see those audition tapes. But I had to sit and watch my audition. And I said that line to her, that she was, there's a handsomeness to her that allowed me to have sex with her. So horrifying. So mean. But yes, that was, sadly, that was my creation.
Andrew Rannell stars in the NBC comedy The New Normal. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org.
There is a house down in New Orleans. They call the rising sun.
Earlier this month, more than 50 years after the 1962 release of Bob Dylan's first record, he's released his 35th studio album. It's called Tempest. Now in his 70s, Dylan's about to embark on a North American tour in support of Tempest, a collection of songs that rock critic Ken Tucker says features many feisty, baffling, sometimes beautiful moments.
I'll walk across the desert till I've been right back by. I won't even think about what I left behind. There's nothing back there anyway. I can call my own, go back home, leave me alone. It's a long road, it's a long and narrow way. If I can't work up to you, you'll surely have to work down to me someday.
Bob Dylan made the rare mistake of talking about his creative process on the eve of the release of Tempest. He told Rolling Stone that he'd originally wanted to write a collection of what he called religious songs. That takes a lot more concentration to pull that off 10 times with the same thread, he said, than it does with a record like I ended up with. Which means either that his powers of concentration failed him, or that he became distracted by other themes, topics, moods. I think it's a little bit of both. There are certainly songs here that sound less like concerted efforts than outpourings of rambling thoughts. There are also songs here that are as precisely crafted as any he's written. Take, for example, Soon After Midnight.
I'm searching for phrases to sing your praises. I need to tell someone. It's soon after midnight and my day has just begun. She was passing by. It's soon after midnight, and the moon is in my eye.
The beauty of the opening moments of Soon After Midnight, the way the music rises up like mist to envelop the tender couplet, I'm searching for phrases to sing your praises, is something to be cherished. We're better human beings for hearing such music. The melody is reminiscent of a 1950s doo-wop ballad, at once stately and deeply romantic. The lyric, however, is grounded in a kind of coarse realism that Dylan insists upon at nearly every turn on this collection, which clocks in as one of his longest albums ever. Indeed, much of the tension in this new music comes from the contrast between the ringing loveliness of the guitars of Dylan and his band and Dylan's growled words of sarcasm and a denial of repentance, boasts of sexual prowess, and looks back in anger.
It's been such a long, long time since we loved each other, but our hearts were true. What time
For one brief day, I was the man for you. Last night I heard you talking in your sleep, saying things you shouldn't say. Oh, baby, you just might have to go to jail someday.
I have to grope outside of music to find expressions of thwarted love, of remembering painful stretches of life, as they're expressed on that song, Long and Wasted Years. The song describes love gone slowly, steadily more sour, with a ruthlessness shaped by wit that reminds me of some of Philip Roth's fiction or Philip Larkin's poetry. When Dylan sings, "Ever hurt your feelings, I apologize," the sentiment is completely denied by the witheringly insincere tone of his voice. Make no mistake about it, a lot of the music here is mean-spirited and goatishly crude. No graphic rap music has anything on the brutal phrases Dylan uses to describe some women and the revenge he exacts upon various foes and victims who, in the title of another song, pay in blood. And he's vehement about making clear that the blood isn't his.
Well, I'm grinding my life out, steady and sure. Nothing more wretched than what I must endure. I'm drenched in the light that shines from the sun. I could stone you to death for the wrongs that you've done. Sooner or later, you'll make a mistake. I put you in a chain that you never would break. Legs and arms and body and bone, I pay in blood, but on my own.
The latter half of the album consists of long compositions that borrow from various genres, from the blues to sea shanties. The song that's received the most media attention is the title tune, an almost 14-minute white wail about the sinking of the Titanic, in which Dylan mixes historical fact, imagined dialogue from real figures, and a cameo by Leonardo DiCaprio, not even appearing as his film character Jack Dawson, but clinging to his sketchbook like a life raft.
Leo took his sketchbook. He was often so inclined. He closed his eyes and painted the scenery in his mind. Cupid struck his bosom and broke it with a snap. The closest woman to him, he fell into her lap. He heard a loud commotion, something sounded wrong. His inner spirit was saying that he couldn't stand here long. He staggered to the quarterdeck, no time now to sleep. Water on the quarterdeck, already 3 foot deep.
Tempest, the album, is bookended by two fascinating songs, one heartfelt but flawed, the other nearly perfect. The album closer is Roll On John, Dylan's salute to John Lennon, complete with Dylan's version of sampling, folding Lennon lyrics into his own. The opener is Duquesne Whistle, with lyrics co-written by Robert Hunter. Its jazzy jauntiness is devilish and sly. It presents a Bob Dylan completely enthralled by his music, like a kid in a musical candy store gorging on rare sweetness as though it was life-sustaining sustenance.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Bob Dylan's new album, Tempest. Coming up, Britannia, an extraordinarily cute 11-week-old puppy, visits the Fresh Air studio. We'll hear about a new program that trains search and rescue dogs at the University of Pennsylvania's Penn Vet Working Dog Center. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Following the attacks of September 11, 2001, search and rescue dogs helped look for the living and the dead in the rubble at Ground Zero. On September 11th of this year, a new detection dog training center opened at the University of Pennsylvania to train dogs for search and rescue missions and to study what helps them succeed. To learn about this new center, Terry spoke with two guests, Dr. Cynthia Otto and Anne Marie D'Angelo. Dr. Otto is the founding director of the Penn Vet Working Dog Center and a veterinarian who tended to the health needs of working dogs at Ground Zero. Anne Marie D'Angelo is the center's training director. She founded the New Jersey State Police Canine Unit. With her dog partners, she searched for missing children, criminals, and drugs. And there's a third guest, an extraordinarily cute 11-week-old puppy who's beginning her training as a detection dog. The dogs at the center who graduate successfully will go on to work with national security organizations, including the military and local police departments.
Dr. Cynthia Otto, Anne Marie D'Angelo, welcome to Fresh Air, and welcome to the dog you've brought with you, Britannia. Tell us a little bit about the dog.
Britannia is an 11-week-old golden retriever, and she actually wants to speak for herself, clearly here. She was donated by a kennel in Illinois, and she is from a hunting line, and she is from a very sound line where they're very concerned about their health and their performance in hunting, and that is why we accepted her as our very first puppy in the Penn Vet Working Dog Center.
Anne Marie D'Angelo, you're the director of training at the new Penn Vet Working Dog Center. So the dog that is with you both today, she's going to be one of the dogs you're training.
Yes, she is.
She's already being trained now.
Yes.
But she's an adorable puppy right now. I mean, she's just so cute. And she's sitting on a chair in between the two of you. She has a little, like, candy cane striped fluffy toy, like rope toy, that she's been playing with. And Emery, you've been petting her and tickling her and giving her little, you've both been giving her little treats. So she's very much a puppy now, though I could see you've already taught her how to, like, sit and lay and, you know, answer certain commands. So at this stage, how many months did you say she was?
She's 11 weeks.
11 weeks. She's just so young. Now, do you know what job she's both best suited for? Is that something you're going to have to figure out during the course of the training?
Yeah, we'll figure that out as time goes along. So no, nothing right now.
How are you going to tell what she's best suited for?
Well, we'll see how she searches. You know, if she's a real aggressive searcher, we may put her towards one thing. If she's methodical, we might focus her more on another substance. And also, I believe that what the demand is at the time when she's ready to go will also have something to do with what she's trained in. But as long as she has all the basics and we teach her during training the different search techniques and how to apply herself, she'll have a really good upper hand on everything.
So you don't train just any dog. You're looking for certain traits, and certain breeds have those traits more than others do. What are the breeds that work best for the search and detection missions that you're training dogs for?
I think that we rely on breeds because those breeds have been used, and the hunting breeds are definitely a major source, particularly the Labradors and the Golden Retrievers. But the herding breeds, like the German Shepherds, the Belgian Malinois, the Border Collies as well, those have all been used successfully. And to me, it's not as much the breed as it is the dog and their drive. And when we talk about drive, we're talking about that need to go and find the ball for the 67th time, you know, so it just keeps going and it really wants to work and do that, and it loves that. And that's what we're looking for in the dog. We're also interested in their physical characteristics. So when we're looking at dogs, we're looking for health. We're looking for a dog that's structurally sound. So we're probably not going to pick any bulldogs because they just aren't going to have that physical fitness, that capacity, and they also don't have much of a nose, so that they're not able to actually take advantage of all of that area of the longer-nosed dogs.
Anne Marie, let's talk about training. You teach dogs how to identify and then search for scents.
Yes, ma'am.
Where do you start? I mean, like Britannia, the adorable little puppy sitting between you right now, you're going to be teaching her soon how to search for scent. What's the first step?
Well, like Dr. Otto just said, you look for that dog who likes to chase that ball so many times. So the beginning part would be basic retrieves, just throwing the ball out, throwing the toy out, allowing the dog to go have fun and go find it, bring it back to you, and then you start to hide it. where it's sort of invisible to the dog, but maybe not quite as obvious. Send them out again. The whole time you're giving them the same command, whether it's search or find it, whatever the handler, the trainer chooses to do. And once the dog learns to start to search, you begin to hide it in more complex places so that he or she will have to find that object really hidden. During that period, you will scent that article up, scent the towel or the ball with the substance that you want them to find. So if you want them to find narcotics, you would do that. You would scent the article up with that. So it's the whole training experience is a game. It's a game for the dog. They're having a good time, and the more they love to play, the better that they are.
Say you're teaching the dog to search for human remains.
They have substances that you can purchase that have the same odor. We also have people that, when they pass, they allow you to use their you know body fluids or skin samples to train the dogs with that also.
Oh, interesting. So
you can use, you know, nail clippings, hair samples, teeth pulled, things like that. Those items are all used when we train the dogs.
What would you like to know, Dr. Cynthia Otto, about what goes on in a dog's nose that enables a dog to experience all these smells that humans cannot?
I would love to have a picture of what they see with their nose. I would love to be able to figure out what the wiring is, because dogs use their noses like we use our eyes. We see in multicolor in three dimensions, and dogs smell in multicolor in three dimensions. They can pick out the individual components of a smell. They can break it down, but they can also recognize that combined components. And so they can recognize one person from another. They can recognize parts, but they can also generalize. They can recognize the drugs that are hidden in coffee grounds, the drugs that are hidden with perfume around them. So they can pull that scent out and just piece it. And I would love to know the wiring that makes that work, because it's fascinating. How do they capture that information, process it in their brain, and then respond to it? That to me is just absolutely fascinating.
What do you hope to learn at the new center, the new training center that you've set up for dogs, either about how dogs smell or how they can best be trained in detection?
I think one of the most unique aspects of our program is that we're bringing our puppies in at 8 weeks. And those puppies are, first of all, living with foster families during the rest of their lives. But from Monday through Friday, from 8 to 5, they come into our center and they get their foundation work. It's kind of like a puppy college. So they'll be in class during that time. And part of what we want to do is we want to figure out what are the best techniques, what can they learn at what age. So one of the most challenging things that we have is all of the information that we're capturing. So this is about collecting data. We are recording how often they are trying to do a behavior, how successful, how fast, how many repetitions, do we have to ask them more than once. And then that will allow us to kind of plot the progress and the success and combine that with different behavioral tests, genetic tests, and that those pieces of knowing when we can look back and say, wow, we knew at 16 weeks this dog was destined to become this. Because right now there are no good tests when they're puppies to tell if they're going to be successful. So we want to collect that information, but we also want to take advantage of the early childhood development of the puppies and help to see if we can't influence their brain development in a way that's going to make them happier doing their job, more resilient to the stresses that they face, because they're not stresses anymore, because this is just their normal life. They're used to going to work for 8 hours a day. They're used to going in all sorts of places. They'll be taken on field trips. They're going to go all over the place as they're young.
So I'm looking at this adorable 11-week-old puppy Britannia, who's sitting on a little chair, actually on a regular chair, between the two of you, and you've both been giving her teeny little treats. So how are you using treats now at 11 weeks old as she prepares to be more seriously trained?
Puppies respond very well to treats. They're always hungry. They always want to eat. And treats are a form of positive reinforcement where she does a correct behavior and she's given the treat. They teach the puppy to focus on the handler, on the trainer, and it just makes them, it makes it fun for her. You also see we have some toys around, so we'll play with her a little bit. But mostly the treats are keeping her attention right now.
And are you rewarding her for just sitting there nicely in the chair?
I'm rewarding her for various behavior. Right now, I just asked her to focus, which is to look at me. I've asked her several times to sit or down in the chair just to kind of break things up.
Whoops, she just fell off the chair. She wasn't paying attention.
She was not. Puppies are very clumsy.
I don't think they're used to sitting on chairs.
No. We have not trained her to sit on the chair.
Especially one with wheels.
Oh, good point, yes. Well, puppies particularly aren't on office chairs very often.
But that is something that is a good exposure for her, to be on something that moves out from under her and to have her confidence, because in a searching situation, she may have to maneuver around things that move. And so this building, this sense of no fear is actually really, this is part of her training. And also her being able to sit here calmly and not kind of lose her mind is really part of the training. We want them to be ready to go. And when they're going full steam. But when they're relaxing, then they need to learn how to kind of be contained. And that's an important part of her training.
Now, she's wearing a little, like, pen vet vest on. And one search and rescue dog trainer I spoke to talked about how when a dog has his or her vest on, the dog knows that they're at work. It's not time for play. It's time for work. When the vest is off, it's time for play. Does Britannia know that yet? Is that a vest that's supposed to signify work, or is that just like a cute vest signifying that she is part of the pen vet program?
It is a vest that signifies work. Brit has not made that connection yet. Right now, she knows that she puts it on, and she doesn't know. But eventually, she will, because when she has the vest on, she's not supposed to socialize with people and go out and play. And she'll make that connection during training, but she doesn't have it yet.
So tell us about a mission that you did with the New Jersey Police with one of your dogs that you're very proud of.
Yeah, I was always proud to work with my dog. And when I came in, the patrol program was just the patrol dog program was really just getting started. My dog and one of the other troopers that were there, we had the first two patrol dogs in the program, so they weren't really used like they are now. The missions that they go on now are much, much more exciting. Just tracks of fugitives, you know, fugitives for wanted for assaulting a police officer. They're always exciting because they're out in the woods and you're looking for them, and you don't know if they're armed or they're not armed, and you have the helicopters flying all around, and you have the streets blocked off. And then, you know, the dog goes up some steep trestles and goes through some woods. And you know, my dog eventually found the guy. So that's always...
Where was the guy? Where was he hiding?
He was actually bedded down under some, wooded... It's a wooded area. So, you know, hiding in the weeds. And he pretty much surrendered when the dog approached. Because if you got a dog out there, people don't want to get bit. You know, most of them.
Okay, so the biggest drug bust you ever did with a dog was how big?
1,200 kilos of cocaine.
Okay, how did the dog find it?
It was in a tractor trailer, and we did an exterior search to see if the dog would alert to the odor of narcotics. And he did, and we went and got a search warrant, and then we took the trailer apart and emptied it out, and inside was 1,200 kilos of cocaine.
So you can get a search warrant based on the fact that the dog smells something.
Yes, the dog sniffs the air around. It's called a free air search. And in this case, the trailer was abandoned. We knew who had driven it there. They kind of left it. So I did an exterior search with the dog. He sniffed the air around the outside of the trailer, indicated. We used that with other things that we had gathered and got a judge to issue a search warrant for the tractor trailer.
And you're the person who speaks on the dog's behalf?
I do.
The dog that is with you both today, Britannia, how long is her training likely to be? And assuming she graduates and makes it, because not all dogs do, how long is her career likely to be?
She'll probably stay with us for at least 12 to 14 months. And again, that depends. This is a new program, so the exact amount of time, I would say at least a year, she'll be with us before she graduates. Her career, you know, I've had dogs that worked till they were 10 and 11. Of course, you have to really monitor their health and look at the demands on the job. You know, if they're doing something like 9/11 up at the World Trade Center, you know, do you really want to take an older dog into that type of search? But if it's a wood search or it's something that it's not really tough on their body and they can still handle it, can they work? Yeah, they love it. It's a great job, you know, for them. My Labrador told me when it was time, when he didn't want to work anymore.
How did he tell you?
He stopped getting up to go in the car.
Really?
Yes, he was 12 years old, and I had already had my second dog, so the second dog was doing all the, he was doing all the real jobs, and I would bring Bud out just to do a search that I would put out for him. But one day, he just said, no more. You know, I'm done. I'd rather just lay here on the kitchen floor and be a bum. And so he stayed home, and we just went for walks, and, you know, that's how he enjoyed the rest of his life. But he went to work with me every day until he said no more.
And you were ready for it. You were ready to hear that.
No, I was there. You're never ready to hear that. You're absolutely never ready to hear that. I had him for a few more years before he passed. But, you know, it's hard. You know, when you take an animal who is your partner to work with you every day for 10 years and then all of a sudden it's over, you know, it's hard to take.
Anne Marie D'Angelo is the training director of the Penn Vet Working Dog Center. Dr. Cynthia Otto is the center's founding director. You'll find a longer version of their conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. We took some photos of the puppy Britannia. You can see them on Twitter using the hashtag NPRFreshAir. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.